plans for a significant portion of my last book while on foot, and made progress on many knotty technical problems in my academic research. I suggest that you adopt a productive meditation practice in your own life. You don't necessarily need a serious session every day, but your goal should be to participate in at least 2 or 3 such sessions in a typical week. Fortunately, finding time for this strategy is easy, as it takes advantage of periods that would otherwise be wasted, such as walking the dog or commuting to work, and, if done right, can actually increase your professional productivity instead of taking time away from your work. In fact, you might even consider scheduling a walk during your workday specifically for the purpose of applying productive meditation to your most pressing problem at the moment. I'm not, however, suggesting this practice for its productivity benefits, though they're nice. I'm instead interested in its ability to rapidly improve your ability to think deeply. In my experience, productive meditation builds on both of the key ideas introduced at the beginning of this rule. By forcing you to resist distraction and return your attention repeatedly to a well-defined problem, it helps strengthen your distraction-resisting muscles. And by forcing you to push your focus deeper and deeper on a single problem, it sharpens your concentration. To succeed with productive meditation, it's important to recognize that, like any form of meditation, it requires practice to do well. When I first attempted this strategy back in the early weeks of my postdoc, I found myself hopelessly distracted, ending long stretches of thinking with little new to show for my efforts. It took me a dozen or so sessions before I began to experience real results. You should expect something similar, so patience will be necessary. To help accelerate this ramp-up process, however, I have 2 specific suggestions to offer. Suggestion number 1. Be wary of distractions and looping. As a novice, when you begin a productive meditation session, your mind's first act of rebellion will be to offer unrelated but seemingly more interesting thoughts. My mind, for example, was often successful at derailing my attention by beginning to compose an email that I knew I needed to write. Objectively speaking, this train of thought sounds exceedingly dull, but in the moment it can become impossibly tantalizing. When you notice your attention slipping away from the problem at hand, gently remind yourself that you can return to that thought later, then redirect your attention back. Distraction of this type, in many ways, is the obvious enemy to defeat in developing a productive meditation habit. A subtler but equally effective adversary is looping. When faced with a hard problem, your mind, as it was evolved to do, will attempt to avoid excess expenditure of energy when possible. One way it might attempt to sidestep this expenditure is by avoiding diving deeper into the problem by instead looping over and over again on what you already know about it. For example, when working on a proof, my mind has a tendency to rehash simple preliminary results again and again, to avoid the harder work of building on these results toward the needed solution. You must be on your guard for looping, as it can quickly subvert an entire productive meditation session. When you notice it, remark to yourself that you seem to be in a loop. Then, redirect your attention toward the next step. Suggestion number 2. Structure your deep thinking. Thinking deeply about a problem seems like a self-evident activity, but in reality, it's not. When faced with a distraction-free mental landscape, a hard problem, and time to think, the next steps can become surprisingly non-obvious. In my experience, it helps to have some structure for this deep thinking process. I suggest starting with a careful review of the relevant variables for solving the problem, and then storing these values in your working memory. For example, if you're working on the outline for a book chapter, the relevant variables might be the main points you want to make in the chapter. If you're instead trying to solve a mathematics proof, These variables might be actual variables, or assumptions, or lemmas. Once the relevant variables are identified, define the specific next step question you need to answer using these variables. In the book chapter example, this next step question might be, how am I going to effectively open this chapter? And for a proof, it might be, what can go wrong if I don't assume this property holds? With the relevant variables stored and the next step question identified, you now have a specific target for your attention. Assuming you're able to solve your next step question, the final step of this structured approach to deep thinking is to consolidate your gains by reviewing clearly the answer you identified. At this point, you can push yourself to the next level of depth by starting the process over. This cycle of reviewing and storing variables, identifying and tackling the next step question, then consolidating your gains, is like an intense workout routine for your concentration ability. It will help you get more out of your productive meditation sessions and accelerate the pace at which you improve your ability to go deep. Memorize a deck of cards. Given just 5 minutes, Daniel Kilov can memorize any of the following: a shuffled deck of cards, a string of 100 random digits, or 115 abstract shapes, this last feat establishing an Australian national record. It shouldn't be surprising, therefore, that Kilov recently won back-to-back silver medals in the Australian Memory Championships. What is perhaps surprising, given Kilov's history, is that he ended up a mental athlete at all. "I wasn't born with an exceptional memory," Kilov told me. Indeed, during high school, he considered himself forgetful and disorganized. He also struggled academically and was eventually diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. It was after a chance encounter with Tansel Ali, one of the country's most successful and visible memory champions, that Kilov began to seriously train his memory. By the time he earned his college degree, he had won his first national competition medal. This transformation into a world-class mental athlete was rapid, but not unprecedented. In 2006, the American science writer Joshua Foer won the USA Memory Championship after only a year of intense training, a journey he chronicled in his 2011 bestseller, Moonwalking with Einstein. But what's important to us about Kilov's story is what happened to his academic performance during this period of intensive memory development. While training his brain, he went from a struggling student with attention deficit disorder to graduating from a demanding Australian university with first-class honors. He was soon accepted into the PhD program at one of the country's top universities, where he currently studies under a renowned philosopher. One explanation for this transformation comes from research led by Henry Roediger, who runs the Memory Lab at the University of Washington at St. Louis. In 2014, Roediger and his collaborators sent a team equipped with a battery of cognitive tests to the Extreme Memory Tournament held in San Diego. They wanted to understand what differentiated these elite memorizers from the population at large. "We found that one of the biggest differences between memory athletes and the rest of us is in a cognitive ability that's not a direct measure of memory at all, but of attention," explained Roediger in a New York Times blog post. "The ability in question is called attentional control, and it measures the subject's ability to maintain their focus on essential information." A side effect of memory training, in other words, is an improvement in your general ability to concentrate. This ability can then be fruitfully applied to any task demanding deep work. Daniel Kilov, we can therefore conjecture, didn't become a star student because of his award-winning memory. It was instead his quest to improve this memory that, incidentally, gave him the deep work edge needed to thrive academically. The strategy described here asks you to replicate a key piece of Kilov's training, and therefore gain some of the same improvements to your concentration. In particular, it asks you to learn a standard but quite impressive skill in the repertoire of most mental athletes, the ability to memorize a shuffled deck of cards. The technique for card memorization I'll teach you comes from someone who knows quite a bit about this particular challenge, Ron White, a former USA memory champion and world record holder in card memorization. The first thing White emphasizes is that professional memory athletes never attempt rote memorization. That is, where you simply look at information again and again, repeating it in your head. This approach to retention, though popular among burned-out students, misunderstands how our brains work. We're not wired to quickly internalize abstract information. We are, however, really good at remembering scenes. Think back to a recent memorable event in your life, perhaps attending the opening session of a conference or meeting a friend you haven't seen in a while for a drink. Try to picture the scene as clearly as possible. Most people in this scenario can conjure a surprisingly vivid recollection of the event, even though you made no special effort to remember it at the time. If you systematically counted the unique details in this memory, the total number of items would likely be surprisingly numerous. Your mind, in other words, can quickly retain lots of detailed information if it's stored in the right way. Ron White's card memorization technique builds on this insight. To prepare for this high-volume memorization task, White recommends that you begin by cementing in your mind the mental image of walking through 5 rooms in your home. Perhaps you come in the door, walk through your front hallway, then turn into the downstairs bathroom, walk out the door and enter the guest bedroom, walk into the kitchen, and then head down the stairs into your basement. In each room, conjure a clear image of what you see. Once you can easily recall this mental walkthrough of a well-known location, fix in your mind a collection of 10 items in each of these rooms. White recommends that these items be large and therefore more memorable, like a desk, not a pencil. Next, establish an order in which you look at each of these items in each room. For example, in the front hallway, you might look at the entry mat, then shoes on the floor by the mat, then the bench above the shoes, and so on. Combined, this is only 50 items, so add 2 more items, perhaps in your backyard, to get to the full 52 items you'll later need when connecting these images to all the cards in a standard deck. Practice this mental exercise of walking through the rooms and looking at items in each room in a set order. You should find that this type of memorization, because it's based on visual images of familiar places and things, will be much easier than the rote memorizing you might remember from your school days. The second step in preparing to memorize a deck of cards is to associate a memorable person or thing with each of the 52 possible cards. To make this process easier, try to maintain some logical association between the card and the corresponding image. White provides the example of associating Donald Trump with the King of Diamonds, as diamonds signify wealth. Practice these associations until you can pull a card randomly from the deck and immediately recall the associated image. As before, the use of memorable visual images and associations will simplify the task of forming these connections. The 2 steps mentioned previously are advanced steps, things you do just once and can then leverage again and again in memorizing specific decks. Once these steps are done, you're ready for the main event, memorizing as quickly as possible the order of 52 cards in a freshly shuffled deck. The method here is straightforward. Begin your mental walkthrough of your house. As you encounter each item, look at the next card from the shuffled deck and imagine the corresponding memorable person or thing doing something memorable near that item. For example, if the first item in location is the mat in your front entry and the first card is the King of Diamonds, you might picture Donald Trump wiping mud off of his expensive loafers on the entry mat in your front hallway. Proceed carefully through the rooms, associating the proper mental images with objects in the proper order. After you complete a room, you might want to walk through it a few times in a row to lock in the imagery. Once you're done, you're ready to hand the deck to a friend and amaze him by rattling off the cards in order without peeking. To do so, of course, simply requires that you perform the mental walkthrough one more time, connecting each memorable person or thing to its corresponding card as you turn your attention to it. If you practice this technique, you'll discover, like many mental athletes who came before you, that you can eventually internalize a whole deck in just minutes. More important than your ability to impress friends, of course, is the training such activities provide your mind. Proceeding through the steps described earlier requires that you focus your attention again and again on a clear target. Like a muscle responding to weights, this will strengthen your general ability to concentrate, allowing you to go deeper with more ease. It's worth emphasizing, however, the obvious point that there's nothing special about card memorization. Any structured thought process that requires unwavering attention can have a similar effect. Be it studying the Talmud, like Adam Marlin from Rule Number 2's introduction, or practicing productive meditation, or trying to learn the guitar part of a song by ear, a past favorite of mine. If card memorization seems weird to you, in other words, then choose a replacement that makes similar cognitive requirements. The key to this strategy is not the specifics, but instead the motivating idea that your ability to concentrate is only as strong as your commitment to train it. Rule number 3. Quit social media. In 2013, author and digital media consultant Baratunde Thurston launched an experiment. He decided to disconnect from his online life for 25 days. No Facebook, no Twitter, no Foursquare, a service that awarded him Mayor of the Year in 2011. Not even email. He needed the break. Thurston, who is described by friends as the most connected man in the world, had, by his own count, participated in more than 59,000 Gmail conversations and posted 1,500 times on his Facebook wall in the year leading up to his experiment. "I was burnt out, fried, done, toast," he explained. We know about Thurston's experiment because he wrote about it in a cover article for Fast Company magazine, ironically titled #Unplug. As Thurston reveals in the article, it didn't take long to adjust to a disconnected life. By the end of that first week, the quiet rhythm of my days seemed far less strange, he said. I was less stressed about not knowing new things. I felt that I still existed despite not having shared documentary evidence of said existence on the internet. Thurston struck up conversations with strangers. He enjoyed food without Instagramming the experience. He bought a bike. Turns out it's easier to ride the thing when you're not trying to simultaneously check your Twitter. The end came too soon, Thurston lamented. But he had startups to run and books to market. So after the 25 days passed, he reluctantly reactivated his online presence. Baratunde Thurston's experiment neatly summarizes two important points about our culture's current relationship with social networks like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and infotainment sites like Business Insider and BuzzFeed, two categories of online distraction that I will collectively call network tools in the sections ahead. The first point is that we increasingly recognize that these tools fragment our time and reduce our ability to concentrate. This reality no longer generates much debate. We all feel it. This is a real problem for many different people. But the problem is especially dire if you're attempting to improve your ability to work deeply. In the preceding rule, for example, I described several strategies to help you sharpen your focus. These efforts will become significantly more difficult if you simultaneously behave like a pre-experiment Baratunde Thurston allowing your life outside such training to remain a distracted blur of apps and browser tabs. Willpower is limited, and therefore, the more enticing tools you have pulling at your attention, the harder it'll be to maintain focus on something important. To master the art of deep work, therefore, you must take back control of your time and attention from the many diversions that attempt to steal them. Before we begin fighting back against these distractions, however, we must better understand the battlefield. This brings me to the second important point summarized by Baratunde Thurston's story: the impotence with which knowledge workers currently discuss this problem of network tools and attention. Overwhelmed by these tools' demands on his time, Thurston felt that his only option was to, temporarily, quit the internet altogether. This idea that a drastic internet sabbatical is the only alternative to the distraction generated by social media and infotainment has increasingly pervaded our cultural conversation. The problem with this binary response to this issue is that these two choices are much too crude to be useful. The notion that you would quit the internet is, of course, an overstuffed straw man, infeasible for most, unless you're a journalist writing a piece about distraction. No one is meant to actually follow Baratunde Thurston's lead, and this reality provides justification for remaining with the only offered alternative: accepting our current distracted state as inevitable. For all the insight and clarity that Thurston gained during his internet sabbatical, for example, it didn't take him long once the experiment ended to slide back into the fragmented state where he began. On the day when I first started writing this chapter, which fell only 6 months after Thurston's article originally appeared in Fast Company, the reformed connector had already sent a dozen tweets in the few hours since he woke up. This rule attempts to break us out of this rut by proposing a third option: accepting that these tools are not inherently evil, and that some of them might be quite vital to your success and happiness, but at the same time, also accepting that the threshold for allowing a site regular access to your time and attention, not to mention personal data, should be much more stringent, and that most people should therefore be using many fewer such tools. I won't ask you, in other words, to quit the internet altogether like Baratunde Thurston did for 25 days back in 2013, but I will ask you to reject the state of distracted hyperconnectedness that drove him to that drastic experiment in the first place. There is a middle ground, and if you're interested in developing a deep work habit, you must fight to get there. Our first step toward finding this middle ground in network tool selection is to understand the current default decision process deployed by most internet users. In the fall of 2013, I received insight into this process because of an article I wrote explaining why I never joined Facebook. Though the piece was meant to be explanatory and not accusatory, it nonetheless put many readers on the defensive, leading them to reply with justifications for their use of the service. Here are some examples of these justifications. Entertainment was my initial draw to Facebook. I can see what my friends are up to and post funny photos, make quick comments. When I first joined, I didn't know why. By mere curiosity, I joined a forum of short fiction stories. Once there, I improved my writing and made very good friends. I use Facebook because a lot of people I knew in high school are on there. Here's what strikes me about these responses, which are representative of the large amount of feedback I received on this topic. They're surprisingly minor. I don't doubt, for example, that the first commenter from this list finds some entertainment in using Facebook, but I would also assume that this person wasn't suffering some severe deficit of entertainment options before he or she signed up for the service. I would further wager that this user would succeed in staving off boredom even if the service were suddenly shut down. Facebook, at best, added one more, arguably quite mediocre, entertainment option to many that already existed. Another commenter cited making friends in a writing forum. I don't doubt the existence of these friends, but we can assume that these friendships are lightweight, given that they're based on sending short messages back and forth over a computer network. There's nothing wrong with such lightweight friendships, but they're unlikely to be at the center of this user's social life. Something similar can be said about the commenter who reconnected with high school friends. This is a nice diversion, but hardly something central to his or her sense of social connection or happiness. To be clear, I'm not trying to denigrate the benefits identified previously. There's nothing illusory or misguided about them. What I'm emphasizing, however, is that these benefits are minor and somewhat random. By contrast, if you'd instead asked someone to justify the use of, say, the World Wide Web more generally, or email, the arguments would become much more concrete and compelling. To this observation, you might reply that value is value. If you can find some extra benefit in using a service like Facebook, even if it's small, then why not use it? I call this way of thinking the any-benefit mindset, as it identifies any possible benefit as sufficient justification for using a network tool. In more detail, the any-benefit approach to network tool selection. You're justified in using a network tool if you can identify any possible benefit to its use, or anything you might possibly miss out on if you don't use it. The problem with this approach, of course, is that it ignores all the negatives that come along with the tools in question. These services are engineered to be addictive, robbing time and attention from activities that more directly support your professional and personal goals, such as deep work. Eventually, if you use these tools enough, you'll arrive at the state of burned-out, hyper-distracted connectivity that plagued Baratunde Thurston and millions of others like him. It's here that we encounter the true, insidious nature of an any-benefit mindset. The use of network tools can be harmful. If you don't attempt to weigh pros against cons, but instead use any glimpse of some potential benefit as justification for unrestrained use of a tool, then you are unwittingly crippling your ability to succeed in the world of knowledge work. This conclusion, if considered objectively, shouldn't be surprising. In the context of network tools, we've become comfortable with the any-benefit mindset. But if we instead zoom out and consider this mindset in the broader context of skilled labor, it suddenly seems a bizarre and ahistorical approach to choosing tools. In other words, once you put aside the revolutionary rhetoric surrounding all things internet, the sense summarized in part one that you're either fully committed to the revolution or a Luddite curmudgeon, you'll soon realize that network tools are not exceptional. They're tools, no different from a blacksmith's hammer or an artist's brush, used by skilled laborers to do their jobs better and occasionally to enhance their leisure. Throughout history, skilled laborers have applied sophistication and skepticism to their encounters with new tools and their decisions about whether to adopt them. There's no reason why knowledge workers cannot do the same when it comes to the internet. The fact that the skilled labor here now involves digital bits doesn't change this reality. To help understand what this more careful tool curation might look like, it makes sense to start by talking to someone who makes a living working with non-digital tools and relies on a complex relationship with these tools to succeed. Fortunately for our purposes, I found just such an individual in a lanky English major turned successful, sustainable farmer named, almost too aptly, Forrest Pritchard. Forrest Pritchard runs Smith Meadows, a family farm located an hour west of D.C., one of many farms clustered in the valleys of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Soon after taking control of the land from his parents, as I learned, Pritchard moved the operation away from traditional monoculture crops and toward the then novel concept of grass-finished meat. The farm bypasses wholesaling. You cannot find Smith Meadows steaks in Whole Foods, to sell direct to consumers at the bustling farmers markets in the Washington, D.C. metro area. By all accounts, the farm is thriving, in an industry that rarely rewards small operations. I first encountered Pritchard at our local farmer's market in Tacoma Park, Maryland, where the Smith Meadows stand does good business. To see Pritchard, usually standing a foot taller than most of his suburbanite customers, wearing the obligatory faded flannel of the farmer, is to see a craftsman confident in his trade. I introduced myself to him because farming is a skill dependent on the careful management of tools, and I wanted to understand how a craftsman in a non-digital field approaches this crucial task. Haymaking is a good example, he told me, not long into one of our conversations on the topic. It's a subject where I can give you the basic idea without having to gloss over the underlying economics. When Pritchard took over Smith Meadows, he explained, the farm made its own hay to use as animal feed during the winter months when grazing is impossible. Haymaking is done with a piece of equipment called a hay baler, a device you pull behind a tractor that compresses and binds dried grass into bales. If you raise animals on the East Coast, there's an obvious reason to own and operate a hay baler. Your animals need hay. Why spend money to buy in feed when you have perfectly good grass growing for free right in your own soil? If a farmer subscribed to the any benefit approach used by knowledge workers, therefore, he would definitely buy a hay baler. But as Pritchard explained to me after preemptively apologizing for a moment of snark, if a farmer actually adopted such a simplistic mindset, I'd be counting the days until the forced sale goes up on the property. Pritchard, like most practitioners of his trade, instead deploys a more sophisticated thought process when assessing tools. And after applying this process to the hay baler, Pritchard was quick to sell it. Smith Meadows now purchases all the hay it uses. Here's why. Let's start by exploring the costs of making hay, Pritchard said. First, there's the actual cost of fuel and repairs and the shed to keep the baler. You also have to pay taxes on it. These directly measurable costs, however, were the easy part of his decision. It was instead the opportunity costs that required more attention. As he elaborated, if I make hay all summer, I can't be doing something else. For example, I now use that time instead to raise boilers, chickens meant for eating. These generate positive cash flow because I can sell them. But they also produce manure, which I can then use to enhance my soil. Then there's the equally subtle issue of assessing the secondary value of a purchased bale of hay. As Pritchard explained, when I'm buying in hay, I'm trading cash for animal protein as well as manure once it passes through the animal system, which means I'm also getting more nutrients from my land in exchange for my money. I'm also avoiding compacting soils by driving heavy machinery over my ground all summer long. When making his final decision on the baler, Pritchard moved past the direct monetary costs, which were essentially a wash, and instead shifted his attention to the more nuanced issue of the long-term health of his fields. For the reasons described previously, Pritchard concluded that buying in hay results in healthier fields, and as he summarized, soil fertility is my baseline. By this calculation, the baler had to go. Notice the complexity of Pritchard's tool decision. This complexity underscores an important reality. The notion that identifying some benefit is sufficient to invest money, time, and attention in a tool is near laughable to people in his trade. Of course, a hay baler offers benefits. Every tool at the farm supply store has something useful to offer. At the same time, of course, it offers negatives as well. Pritchard expected this decision to be nuanced. He began with a clear baseline, in his case, that soil health is of fundamental importance to his professional success, and then built off this foundation toward a final call on whether to use a particular tool. I propose that if you're a knowledge worker, especially one interested in cultivating a deep work habit, you should treat your tool selection with the same level of care as other skilled workers, such as farmers. Following is my attempt to generalize this assessment strategy. I call it The Craftsman Approach to Tool Selection, a name that emphasizes that tools are ultimately aids to the larger goals of one's craft. The Craftsman Approach to Tool Selection. Identify the core factors that determine success and happiness in your professional and personal life. Adopt a tool only if its positive impacts on these factors substantially outweigh its negative impacts. Notice that this craftsman approach to tool selection stands in opposition to the any benefit approach. Whereas the any benefit mindset identifies any potential positive impact as justification for using a tool, the craftsman variant requires that these positive impacts affect factors at the core of what's important to you and that they outweigh the negatives. Even though the craftsman approach rejects the simplicity of the any benefit approach, it doesn't ignore the benefits that currently drive people to network tools or make any advance proclamations about what's good or bad technology. It simply asks that you give any particular network tool the same type of measured, nuanced accounting that tools in other trades have been subjected to throughout the history of skilled labor. The three strategies that follow in this rule are designed to grow your comfort with abandoning the any benefit mindset and instead applying the more thoughtful craftsman philosophy in curating the tools that lay claim to your time and attention. This guidance is important because the craftsman approach is not cut and dry. Identifying what matters most in your life and then attempting to assess the impacts of various tools on these factors doesn't reduce to a simple formula. This task requires practice and experimentation. The strategies that follow provide some structure for this practice and experimentation by forcing you to reconsider your network tools from many different angles. Combined, they should help you cultivate a more sophisticated relationship with your tools that will allow you to take back enough control over your time and attention to enable the rest of the ideas in Part 2 to succeed. Apply the law of the vital few to your internet habits. Malcolm Gladwell doesn't use Twitter. In a 2013 interview, he explained why. "Who says my fans want to hear from me on Twitter?" He then joked, "I know a lot of people would like to see less of me." Michael Lewis, another mega best-selling author, also doesn't use the service, explaining in The Wire, "I don't tweet. I don't Twitter. I couldn't even tell you how to read or where to find a Twitter message." And as mentioned in Part 1, the award-winning New Yorker scribe George Packer also avoids the service, and indeed only recently even succumbed to the necessity of owning a smartphone. These three writers don't think Twitter is useless. They're quick to accept that other writers find it useful. Packer's admission of non-Twitter use, in fact, was written as a response to an unabashedly pro-Twitter article by the New York Times media critic David Carr, a piece in which Carr effused, "And now, nearly a year later, has Twitter turned my brain to mush? No, I'm in narrative on more things in a given moment than I ever thought possible. And instead of spending a half hour surfing in search of illumination, I get a sense of the day's news and how people are reacting to it in the time that it takes to wait for coffee at Starbucks." At the same time, however, Gladwell, Lewis, and Packer don't feel like the service offers them nearly enough advantages to offset its negatives in their particular circumstances. Lewis, for example, worries that adding more accessibility will sap his energy and reduce his ability to research and write great stories, noting, "It's amazing how overly accessible people are. There's a lot of communication in my life that's not enriching. It's impoverishing." While Packer, for his part, worries about distraction, saying, "Twitter is crack for media addicts." He goes so far as to describe Carr's rave about the service as the most frightening picture of the future that I've read thus far in the new decade. We don't have to argue about whether these authors are right in their personal decisions to avoid Twitter and similar tools, because their sales numbers and awards speak for themselves. We can, instead, use these decisions as a courageous illustration of the craftsman approach to tool selection in action. In a time when so many knowledge workers, and especially those in creative fields, are still trapped in the any-benefit mindset, it's refreshing to see a more mature approach to sorting through such services. But the very rareness of these examples reminds us that mature and confident assessments of this type aren't easy to make. Recall the complexity of the thought process highlighted earlier that Forrest Pritchard had to slog through to make a decision on his hay baler. For many knowledge workers and many of the tools in their lives, these decisions will be equally complex. The goal of this strategy, therefore, is to offer some structure to this thought process, a way to reduce some of the complexity of deciding which tools really matter to you. The first step of this strategy is to identify the main high-level goals in both your professional and your personal life. If you have a family, for example, then your personal goals might involve parenting well and running an organized household. In the professional sphere, the details of these goals depend on what you do for a living. In my own work as a professor, for example, I pursue two important goals. One centered on being an effective teacher in the classroom and effective mentor to my graduate students, and another centered on being an effective researcher. While your goals will likely differ, the key is to keep the list limited to what's most important, and to keep the description suitably high level. If your goal includes a specific target, to reach $1 million in sales, or to publish a half dozen papers in a single year, then it's too specific for our purposes here. When you're done, you should have a small number of goals for both the personal and professional areas of your life. Once you've identified these goals, list for each the two or three most important activities that help you satisfy the goal. These activities should be specific enough to allow you to clearly picture doing them. On the other hand, they should be general enough that they're not tied to a one-time outcome. For example, do better research is too general. What does it look like to be doing better research? Well, finish paper on broadcast lower bounds in time for upcoming conference submission is too specific. It's a one-time outcome. A good activity in this context would be something like, regularly read and understand the cutting-edge results in my field. The next step in this strategy is to consider the network tools you currently use. For each such tool, go through the key activities you identified and ask whether the use of the tool has a substantially positive impact, a substantially negative impact, or little impact on your regular and successful participation in the activity. Now comes the important decision. Keep using this tool only if you concluded that it has substantial positive impacts and that these outweigh the negative impacts. To help illustrate this strategy in action, let's consider a case study. For the purposes of this example, assume that Michael Lewis, if asked, would have produced the following goal and corresponding important activities for his writing career. Professional goal: to craft well-written, narrative-driven stories that change the way people understand the world. Key activities supporting this goal: research patiently and deeply. Write carefully and with purpose. Now imagine that Lewis was using this goal to determine whether or not to use Twitter. Our strategy requires him to investigate Twitter's impact on the key activities he listed that support his goal. There's no convincing way to argue that Twitter would make Lewis substantially better at either of these activities. Deep research for Lewis, I assume, requires him to spend weeks and months getting to know a small number of sources. He's a master of the long-form journalism skill of drawing out a source's story over many sessions, and careful writing, of course, requires freedom from distraction. In both cases, Twitter, at best, has no real impact, and at worst could be substantially negative, depending on Lewis's susceptibility to the service's addictive attributes. The conclusion would therefore be that Lewis shouldn't use Twitter. You might argue at this point that confining our example to this single goal is artificial, as it ignores the areas where a service like Twitter has its best chance of contributing. For writers, in particular, Twitter is often presented as a tool to establish connections with your audience that ultimately lead to more sales. For a writer like Michael Lewis, however, marketing doesn't likely merit its own goal when he assesses what's important in his professional life. This follows because his reputation guarantees that he will receive massive coverage in massively influential media channels if the book is really good. His focus, therefore, is much more productively applied to the goal of writing the best possible book than instead trying to squeeze out a few extra sales through inefficient author-driven means. In other words, the question is not whether Twitter has some conceivable benefit to Lewis. It's instead whether Twitter use significantly and positively affects the most important activities in his professional life. What about a less famous writer? In this case, book marketing might play a more primary role in his or her goals. But when forced to identify the two or three most important activities supporting this goal, it's unlikely that the type of lightweight, one-on-one contact enabled by Twitter would make the list. This is the result of simple math. Imagine that our hypothetical author diligently sends 10 individualized tweets a day, 5 days a week, each of which connects one-on-one with a new potential reader. Now imagine that 50% of the people contacted in this manner become loyal fans who will definitely buy the author's next book. Over the 2-year period it might take to write this book, this yields 2,000 sales, a modest boost at best in a marketplace where bestseller status requires 2 or 3 times more sales per week. The question once again is not whether Twitter offers some benefits, but instead whether it offers enough benefits to offset its drag on your time and attention, two resources that are especially valuable to a writer. Having seen an example of this approach applied to a professional context, let's next consider the potentially more disruptive setting of personal goals. In particular, let's apply this approach to one of our culture's most ubiquitous and fiercely defended tools, Facebook. When justifying the use of Facebook or similar social networks, most people cite its importance to their social lives. With this in mind, let's apply our strategy to understand whether Facebook makes the cut due to its positive impact on this aspect of our personal goals. To do so, we'll once again work with a hypothetical goal and key supporting activities. Personal goal: to maintain close and rewarding friendships with a group of people who are important to me. Key activities supporting this goal. 1. Regularly take the time for meaningful connection with those who are most important to me, e.g. a long talk, a meal, joint activity. 2. Give of myself to those who are most important to me, e.g. making non-trivial sacrifices that improve their lives. Not everyone will share this exact goal or supporting activities, but hopefully you'll stipulate that they apply to many people. Let's now step back and apply our strategy's filtering logic to the example of Facebook in the context of this personal goal. This service, of course, offers any number of benefits to your social life. To name a few that are often mentioned, it allows you to catch up with people you haven't seen in a while. It allows you to maintain lightweight contact with people you know but don't run into regularly. It allows you to more easily monitor important events in people's lives, such as whether or not they're married or what their new baby looks like. And it allows you to stumble onto online communities or groups that match your interests. These are real benefits that Facebook undeniably offers. But none of these benefits provide a significant positive impact to the two key activities we listed, both of which are offline and effort-intensive. Our strategy, therefore, would return a perhaps surprising but clear conclusion. Of course, Facebook offers benefits to your social life, but none are important enough to what really matters to you in this area to justify giving it access to your time and attention. To be clear, I'm not arguing that everyone should stop using Facebook. I'm instead showing that for this specific representative case study, the strategy proposed here would suggest dropping this service. I can't imagine, however, other plausible scenarios that would lead to the opposite conclusion. Consider, for example, a college freshman. For someone in this situation, it might be more important to establish new friendships than to support existing relationships. The activities this student identifies for supporting his goal of a thriving social life, therefore, might include something like attend lots of events and socialize with lots of different people. If this is a key activity and you're on a college campus, then a tool like Facebook would have a substantially positive impact and should be used. To give another example, consider someone in the military who's deployed overseas. For this hypothetical soldier, keeping in frequent, lightweight touch with friends and family left back home is a plausible priority, and one that might once again be best supported through social networks. What should be clear from these examples is that this strategy, if applied as described, will lead many people who currently use tools like Facebook or Twitter to abandon them. But not everyone. You might at this point complain about the arbitrariness of allowing only a small number of activities to dominate your decisions about such tools. As we established previously, for example, Facebook has many benefits to your social life. Why would one abandon it just because it doesn't happen to help the small number of activities that we judged most important? What's key to understand here, however, is that this radical reduction of priorities is not arbitrary, but is instead motivated by an idea that has arisen repeatedly in any number of different fields, from client profitability to social equality to prevention of crashes in computer programs. The law of the vital few. In many settings, 80% of a given effect is due to just 20% of the possible causes. For example, it might be the case that 80% of a business's profits come from just 20% of its clients. 80% of a nation's wealth is held by its richest 20% of citizens. Or 80% of computer software crashes come from just 20% of the identified bugs. There's a formal mathematical underpinning to this phenomenon. An 80-20 split is roughly what you would expect when describing a power law distribution over impact, a type of distribution that shows up often when measuring quantities in the real world. But it's probably most useful when applied heuristically as a reminder that, in many cases, contributions to an outcome are not evenly distributed. Moving forward, let's assume that this law holds for the important goals in your life. As we noted, many different activities can contribute to your achieving these goals. The law of the vital few, however, reminds us that the most important 20% or so of these activities provide the bulk of the benefit. Assuming that you could probably list somewhere between 10 and 15 distinct and potentially beneficial activities for each of your life goals, this law says that it's the top 2 or 3 such activities, the number that this strategy asks you to focus on, that make most of the difference in whether or not you succeed with the goal. Even if you accept this result, however, you still might argue that you shouldn't ignore the other 80% of possible beneficial activities. It's true that these less important activities don't contribute nearly as much to your goal as your top 1 or 2, but they can provide some benefit, so why not keep them in the mix? As long as you don't ignore the more important activities, it seems like it can't hurt to also support some of the less important alternatives. This argument, however, misses the key point that all activities, regardless of their importance, consume your same limited store of time and attention. If you service low-impact activities, therefore, you're taking away time you could be spending on higher-impact activities. It's a zero-sum game. And because your time returns substantially more rewards when invested in high-impact activities than when invested in low-impact activities, the more of it you shift to the latter, the lower your overall benefit. The business world understands this math. This is why it's not uncommon to see a company fire unproductive clients. If 80% of their profits come from 20% of their clients, then they make more money by redirecting the energy from low-revenue clients to better service the small number of lucrative contracts. Each hour spent on the latter returns more revenue than each hour spent on the former. The same holds true for your professional and personal goals. By taking the time consumed by low-impact activities, like finding old friends on Facebook, and reinvesting it in high-impact activities, like taking a good friend out to lunch, you end up more successful in your goal. To abandon a network tool using this logic, therefore, is not to miss out on its potential small benefits, but is instead to get more out of the activities you already know to yield large benefits. To return to where we started, for Malcolm Gladwell, Michael Lewis, and George Packer, Twitter doesn't support the 20% of activities that generate the bulk of the success in their writing careers. Even though in isolation, this service might return some minor benefits when their careers are viewed as a whole, they're likely more successful not using Twitter and redirecting that time to more fruitful activities than if they added it into their schedule as one more thing to manage. You should take the same care in deciding which tools you allow to claim your own limited time and attention. Quit social media. When Ryan Nicodemus decided to simplify his life, one of his first targets was his possessions. At the time, Ryan lived alone in a spacious 3-bedroom condo. For years, driven by a consumerist impulse, he had been trying his best to fill this ample space. Now, it was time to reclaim his life from his stuff. The strategy he deployed was simple to describe, but radical in concept. He spent an afternoon packing everything he owned into cardboard boxes, as if he was about to move. In order to transform what he described as a difficult undertaking into something less onerous, he called it a packing party, explaining, "Everything's more exciting when it's a party, right?" Once the packing was done, Nicodemus then spent the next week going through his normal routine. If he needed something that was packed, he would unpack it and put it back where it used to go. At the end of the week, he noticed that the vast majority of his stuff remained untouched in its boxes, so he got rid of it. Stuff accumulates in people's lives, in part because when faced with a specific act of elimination, it's easy to worry. What if I need this one day? And then use this worry as an excuse to keep the item in question sitting around. Nicodemus's packing party provided him with definitive evidence that most of his stuff was not something he needed, and it therefore supported his quest to simplify. The last strategy provided a systematic method to help you begin sorting through the network tools that currently lay claim to your time and attention. This strategy offers you a different but complementary approach to these same issues, and it's inspired by Ryan Nicodemus's approach to getting rid of his useless stuff. In more detail, this strategy asks that you perform the equivalent of a packing party on the social media services that you currently use. Instead of packing, however, you'll instead ban yourself from using them for 30 days. All of them. Facebook, Instagram, Google+, Twitter, Snapchat, Vine, or whatever other services have risen to popularity since I first wrote these words. Don't formally deactivate these services, and this is important. Don't mention online that you'll be signing off. Just stop using them. Cold turkey. If someone reaches out to you by other means and asks why your activity on a particular service has fallen off, you can explain, but don't go out of your way to tell people. After 30 days of this self-imposed network isolation, ask yourself the following two questions about each of the services you temporarily quit.